Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, my buddy, my pal, Donnie Blair from the bands. It's a long list, so I'm going to abbreviate it, I guess. Hagfish, Only Crime, The Toadies, but there's a lot more we discuss in this episode, I assure you. He is a friend of mine and someone that I have a deep admiration for many bands he's been in. And of course, he is also another voice in the greatest story ever told on Turned Out of Punk. And that is the ballad of the Blair brothers, Zach and Donnie, an MVP professional wrestler, which you can hear on episodes 101. Anyway, I'll get into all this in 1 second. Right now, I'm recording from a van in the middle of a parking lot in Milwaukee on tour. And so that could explain the audio problems. A little weird out here by myself, so I'm going to keep this short. You can find me on various forms of social media at Left for Damian. If you want to get in touch with the show, hit up the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That and a Instagram page and a Facebook page for Turned Out of Punk are all run by my brother and guest booker, normally extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. I booked this one myself. Actually, Zach Blair booked this one. But Tristan normally books the show, and you can get in touch with him over there. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know. I play in a band called Fucked Up, hence why I'm in a parking lot in Milwaukee right now. You can find out more information about shows we're playing over at fuckedup.cc. And we've got a bunch of shows. We're on tour right now. We're going to be going across Canada. We got some records available there, a new album called One Day and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, head over to fuckedup.cc for more information on that. On to today's show. As I said off the top, Donnie Blair is on the show. This is an episode I've been wanting to do for a very long time, and it took forever for this to happen. And I apologize because, yeah, this is, as I said off the top, this is part of the greatest story I think that's ever been told on Turned Out of Punk, which we'll get much more into on the episode. You can find out more information about Donnie's band, The Toadies, over at thetoadies.com. And also, Donnie has written an incredible book called Even If It Kills Me, Martial Arts and Rock and Roll and the Mortality ebook. You can find that all available wherever you buy your ebooks, actually, over at Amazon and other places. And it's a fascinating story about a guy's journey. Well, you'll hear. This will be like a preview for that book right now on this episode. Anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. I've got to get out of this parking lot. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Donnie Blair on Turned Out of Punk.
Donnie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so stoked. I've heard you and my brother go for so long, like, well, God damn it, come on.
I know. And that's my fault. I gotta...
Zach's way cooler than me, man. Anyone that's met him, even my wife thinks so.
Well, I know who I'm picking in a fight. I'll tell you that much. And it might not be Zach in this situation.
No. You know what? I had to fight a lot because of my brother's mouth. It wasn't necessarily me. It was him flapping his fucking gums at people. I'm like, oh, yeah, well, my brother will do. Check this out. Like, the fuck's wrong with you? You know? And so then I would have to go in as I got to back my brother's play and just get the shit kicked out of me all the time. All the time I got beaten up, but can't let anyone fuck with my little brother, you know?
Well, we're going to talk about that. And I'm sure we're going to get to the more trained era of your life that you're living in now in terms of fighting skills, awesome. Martial arts skills. Yeah. But before we get there, we got to start them off the way they all start off, which is, Donnie, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
Great fucking question. I think it was, I know Zach has talked about the No Wave record that he's obsessed with, that we're both obsessed with. That would be the first one. And I guess it's our dad brought it home. So basically, kind of, our dad got us into punk rock, you know? That was kind of like, instead of just full on going from Metallica straight to the Sex Pistols and Safety Pins, we already kind of had that entree with No Wave and the whole New Wave movement. And so looking at all the ripped up clothes and all of that stuff wasn't really a weird thing for us, because we were already watching, you know, Boingo Boingo, which if you don't think about it now, like Oingo Boingo aren't punk rock. But back in the day, again, my dad got us into Oingo Boingo because he thought Danny Elfman looks cool, you know? And if you see that stuff, if you see Devo, if you grow up with that, or even the Police, kind of going into punk rock and watching the Sex Pistols or Buzzcocks or something like that, it's really not that difficult, you know? At least it wasn't for us. We're like, oh, okay, this is just a little bit faster and more aggressive, and it makes us tingle and want to go destroy shit, and we're into that, you know? It was just a step up. It was an evolution from what we were already into, you know?
Well, I think with, you know, and Danny Elfman's been on the show, so I definitely consider Oingo Boingo a punk band.
Fuck yeah. Oingo Boingo are just amazing.
Absolutely. But it's funny how that stuff was. Now we just take it for granted how weird that stuff was and how interesting that stuff was. But when you put it into the landscape of Captain and Tennille and the Eagles and even Led Zeppelin, it's so radical.
Yeah. And that's what was, I look back on it, I'm so glad we had our dad and our parents that pushed us with music, because they loved everything, you know. But my dad would, he loved Robin Trower, of course, and ZZ Top and all that stuff. And he and my mom were always playing Steely Dan. She loved the Eagles and that kind of stuff, you know. But Steely Dan was where they met up. They were like, all right, we can have common ground here. So they're still one of our favorite bands. But my dad was also bringing home from the record store, like from the radio station, he would bring Oingo Boingo. He brought No Wave, you know. We still got the Ain't This the Life, like 10-inch that my dad got. We've got Regatta de Blanc, 3 10-inch records. My dad just grabbed them and brought them home, you know. And he would just bring a shit he thought we would like. And if we didn't like it, he'd take it back. Like, okay. That didn't work out. Well, here's this, you know. He turned us on to everything, you know.
Well, you brought up ZZ Top there, and that's another group that I've gotten a better appreciation of, in Texas especially, from doing this podcast. And, like, they're almost like the Texas Ramones in a lot of way. Like, they were the proto-punk in some regards.
They were, because I think just, like, they were already huge before they did Eliminator. Like, I don't really care for anything past Degüello. You know what I mean? I mean, in that record, when that came out, that's all my old man listened to. We had it on 8-track. We had it on vinyl, cassette, everything. Zach and I know that record back and forth. But if you go behind that, there's Tejas, which is amazing. Fandango is amazing. You know, it was just that, you know, like my dad actually, he said right when they started touring, when ZZ Top started touring, he went down to the courthouse in Sherman. He heard some band was going to play. And it was a band sitting up on the courthouse steps. And they turned around. It was ZZ Top. And he watched them for an hour and a half. This is like 1970, 71. You know, no one had really heard of them. Yeah, he had bought their first record, of course, because he was a long hair, which is a different thing than being a hippie. Completely different thing. So many people think, and I've talked to Zach about this, hippies, they were this, peace, love, and all that kind of stuff, and we're going to do this. Long hairs had long hair, hated rednecks, but they would beat the shit out of you. That was the difference. So
there's no peace.
My dad was, fuck that. My dad was a long hair. He loved weed. He loved ZZ Top. He just hated rednecks, you know, but... Don't think he's a hippie, then I'll just kick your ass, you know. So,
well, that sounds like my kind of dude, you know. I hate rednecks and I love weed, so that's all right with me too. But it's interesting when you do think about Texas, because obviously, I think especially in Canada, not being down there, there's obviously like a certain opinion of what Texas is, or certain stereotypes that people hold. But then when you break it down culturally, like so much subversive shit. And cool anarcho kind of vibe stuff, going back to like Rocky Erickson and Electric Flag and Janis Joplin, but like right the way through to Butthole Surfers. And then of course all the stuff that's going on in Denton, like the Denton scene that you guys are kind of a part of too. Like that shit's wild when that starts happening.
It was like, it's my Texas never had, I think whenever Vaughn and all that stuff came out, that was finally the thing that Texas could latch on to. Because other than that, you can't pigeonhole butthole surfers to go in to Pantera, to go into Janis Joplin, to Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know, or, you know, to Erykah Badu, mm-hmm. you know, or anyone. You know what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. kind of weird. Yeah, we do have, we're mainly known for blues rockers and stuff like that. But if you really dig deep, you hear about all these other bands that are from Texas that you don't really know. They didn't know they were from Texas, but they're influencing so many other people that they don't have that Texas sound. Yet we all kind of have, like you said, anarcho vibe. I think that's just how we're raised. Reading about the Texas Revolution and Texas history and basically being a country before it was a state and all of that stuff. You read about it and it gets into your DNA and just your psyche of like, well, everyone's doing that. Fuck that. We're not going to. We're going to go do this. You know, a lot of it is fuck that. We're not going to do that. We're going to do this, you know, and it's a great place to live and grow up. It's got its problems now, unfortunately, but it's still hard to give it up. You know what I mean? So it's still stick in there and fight the good fight, you know?
Well, I think it's like, what was that former governor who once said that Texas is like a bowl of tomato soup and Austin is the blueberry floating in the middle? Describe the political climate. I forget the last governor or two governors ago, I think he had that quote.
It was either Bush or
it was after Bush. It was the guy, yeah.
Rick.
Whatever.
Yeah, I forgot that douche because they made him head of NASA. That's like making me head of NASA. It makes more sense.
But it's interesting when you think about, you know, the political context that all of you guys are kind of growing up in, and all mm-hmm. Texas kids that kind of want to rebel are growing up in. It's like you got to, because rebelling is so much harder to do. When people rebel, they rebel so much fucking harder than a lot of other places.
Texans definitely do. And it goes both ways. It's also weird depending where you live. I mean, where I live in Amarillo is very conservative red area. Yet the majority of my friends, really good friends I have, are Republicans. And they know I'm pretty lefty, you know. They don't give a shit. They're like, all right, whatever. Are we going to roll or not, dumbass? You know, they don't care. It doesn't matter, you know. So I'm lucky in that regard that I don't have to get into a lot of heated political discussions because it's people that are like, okay, who cares? Someone's going to be in as a president in 4 years. Someone isn't. Are we going to not be friends because of that? No, we're not. So let's be friends and we just won't talk about that shit. We'll talk about other things, you know? So I'm kind of lucky. I got lucky in that, you know? Some people aren't, but the majority of my friends are. They're all pretty badass, good stand-up people.
Well, from what Zach's kind of told me growing up, you weren't necessarily in such a tolerant area for people that wanted to be a little bit different.
No, we weren't. And it was also pre-internet. I mean, we got called so many derogatory names. We got called, I mean, we would wear, like, you remember jams? The flower? Yeah. We couldn't even afford jams. So my grandma had to make them, you know, she would make them for us. They were like blams or something like that. I don't know what the fuck they were. They're like super bumper version of jams. But we had long hair, you know, we were wearing Anthrax and SOD and, you know, fucking Black Flag and Voivod shirts, you know, which Voivod, come on, you know, and we were those guys. We were the weird guys in high school and people were picking on and saying that we were never going to do anything. Like, we better go to college because we weren't going to amount to shit. And like, well, then I'm not going to amount to shit because we can't afford college. So we got to figure something out, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of turbulent, you know, of every day. And you don't think about it until you go back and look at it when you're, you know, when you're older, like, wait, every day was a struggle. Not in our household. Our parents were completely supportive. And if we got into fights, you know, my dad would say, well, you know, what happened? And I'd tell him, like, I was walking on the hall and some guy just started screwing with me. And then what happened? Like, well, then we got in a fight and I got beaten up. He goes, okay. And he's bigger than you, right? I'm like, yeah, you know, he's a really good fighter. Like, okay. But did you take any shit from him? Like, no, sir. All right. That's all my dad cared about. Did you take any shit from him? No. Okay. Same with my mom. Our parents weren't, you know, brush your teeth at night, you know, eat your vitamins, eat your vegetables. Like, did you take any shit from anyone? No. Okay. It's all they cared about in our lives. So it was that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was going to ask, where were you getting sort of these like Voivod and all these metal records? Cause like this stuff is not mainstream by anyone's definition, especially then. So where is this kind of coming onto your radar from? Is it through your dad again?
No. At that time we got fucking lucky right around that point. And first off, we met a friend of ours named William. We had just bought Master Puppets. It had just come out like probably the year beforehand, 86. So this is like middle 87, you know? And we bought it. Remember, my mom bought it for us at Target. That's what I remember. So, and we took it home. We're like, fuck, we've heard this is badass. We listened to it for a few days. Then we were like, we got to put this away for a bit. We were not ready for it. Like, at that point, the heaviest shit we listened to was, we were listening to like Malmsteen and Maiden, you know? I mean, again, my mom bought us Live After Death at a Sears, you know what I mean? So, and even before that, our parents had told us, once we got like older, we were getting into music, they were like, all right, boys, we want you to leave your room for a couple of hours, we're going to decorate it. And we were like, oh, this is going to suck so fucking bad, this is going to be horrible. So they were like, all right, come on in, check it out. And they had bought Kiss poster, Great White. They bought the Number of the Beast poster. So our parents put Satan on our walls, you know? They bought this shit for a picture of Heather Thomas in a jacuzzi. We were like, yeah, you guys know we're going to jerk off to this, right? I mean, we're gonna. So, you know, and we did. Like, I think that was my old man's gift. Like, here's my gift to you. Like, okay. You know, I mean, that's what we were being raised with. Our parents were that inclusive and supportive of everything. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, whenever MTV came out, they got us that so we could watch that stuff, you know? So we got into, you know, so much different stuff from MTV, from 120 Minutes to the Headbangers Ball or Rip. Rip had just come out. And we also had a radio station in Dallas called Z-Rock. And it played all metal. We couldn't believe it. You know, it was only an hour away. We listened to it every day, like just religion. It's all we listened to for years was Z-Rock. You know, all of the metal bands would go through. Ozzy would be on there. They would only play Sabbath or Ozzy, Slayer, Guns N' Roses. They'd play whatever was heavy and rock at that point in time, they played it. So we got really lucky being turned on to all this shit at the same time and figuring out, like, Voivod, the fuck is Voivod? So we looked at it, went to our local music land and got Killing Technology. Mind was fucking blown, you know? And we tried it with so many different records, you know? One day we got lucky. We're like, shit, Celtic Frost, Into the Pandemonium. Then the next week, Napalm Death, not so much, you know.
Really? You know what you were doing?
Oh, no. But unfortunately, also tried it with the Cramps. Like, this is going to be amazing. Not so much. But now Cramps are one of my favorite bands in the world. I just wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
You know? Or if anything, if Metallica said it, we're like, okay, we got to find some misfits, you know? So it's just that kind of shit. You know what I mean?
Was there Texas metal? Like, obviously Texas metal becomes such a huge thing, but had that scene already started by that point?
Oh yeah. Rigor mortis. It began and ended there. You know, well, at that point in time, Pantera was around, but they didn't have Phil. They had a guy named Terry Blaze. And I think that was him. I can't really remember. But they would play, God, this place called the Electric Company. And, Sherman, but they only did covers at that point in time. And I remember I just started playing bass a few years previous, and these girls went to go see them. And they were like, Donnie, you would love them. Their bass player's name was Rex Rocker. He was amazing. And I was like, whatever. I didn't know shit. That guy's a fucking stone cold badass. But at that point, he was Rex Rocker.
Yeah.
You know, and they were wearing, everyone knows about, you know, I think their first two records. It's old business. Everybody knows that. And they hadn't become Pantera yet. Mm. But before them was Rigor Mortis. Have you heard Rigor Mortis?
I've heard some stuff after Zach kind of talked them up to me online.
Their first record was on Capitol Records. And we were like, all right, let's go give this a try. And we got it. And it, again, blew our fucking brains. So then we went and saw them at the Arcadia, which is only like maybe, it was 1,200 people, open for Slayer on the South of Heaven tour.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, I think we got a contact high. There was so much weed in there because I had to sit down. We were slamming. And I was like, whoa, I got to sit down. Oh, shit. It was serious. But, you know, it was fantastic. You know, and then Casey and all those guys and Mike, Scotia became great friends of ours. You know, but at that point in time, it was Rigor Mortis. They were the ones pretty much just kind of leading the charge with that. And they were just beyond their time, I think. People couldn't catch up to them. They were so fast, so precise, so amazing. They weren't normal slow metal or any of that. They were way ahead of their time. And so I think they only did a couple of records, you know, before they broke up. But check it out.
That's also like that band Devastation. I think they were ahead of their time. They only did like two LPs, right?
I remember Devastation. Were they Texas as
Texas
well?
Too. I think they might be Dallas. I might be totally off on that, but they were, I think they opened for the Cro-Mags when they first came through, and then they,
they might've been Austin or San Antonio, okay. Something like that. I think they were South. I could be saying that could be completely full of shit, but I'm pretty sure I don't know if they were from Dallas or not.
It's a big state, a lot of music coming out of it. So
fucking huge state, dude. It's such a big state.
When did Forbidden Cause form? Like how long after playing bass?
Oh, nice.
It's a favorite band on this podcast. It comes up all the time.
Oh man, that is crazy. Well, I started in 85. We got that band together in 88, I guess. Before that, we had a band we never played out called Lunacy. That was our first band with the guy William that turned us on to heavy, like basically heavy stuff. We walked into his room and he was playing My War. You know, we met him with his little brother, Brad, but he was playing My War. We were like, what the fuck is this? He was like, you're going to want to hold on to your asses. Check this out. Then he played Rain and Blood. Then he played the first Suicidal. Then he played Spreading the Disease. So Zach and I were like, where the fuck are we? You know? So William and Brad, they were from Florida and they really helped out with our getting to know things and our information and knowledge and finding these bands. We never would have heard of Slayer unless we found them. They turned us on to so many great bands and we just lapped it up. We're like, oh shit, this is kind of like the same stuff from that Metallica record that we got. So then we started putting that back into rotation, you know, and it all just kind of went from there and we never looked back. Like, oh, this speaks to me, you know.
You really needed to rely on someone who had access to stuff back then because there was just no freedom of information.
It wasn't as prevalent. It wasn't like iTunes, you know. Yeah. I mean, now I'm going on iTunes like, oh shit, you can find, you know, the first Violence record on here. Holy shit, you can find DBC. Do you remember Dead Brain Cells?
Yes. Are they from Montreal?
Fuck yeah. Montreal. I know they're Canadian.
I think they're Montreal. That. Montreal was like the metal. That was our Dallas, Texas up here, I guess. Like that was our metal capital.
Well, you got Voivod. So what more do you need? You know?
Yeah. There was. Oh, sorry. Go on.
No, no, you go ahead. Go ahead. Go for it.
No, I was just going to say like Canadian metal is a big thing up here too. It's never celebrated, never really brought up in sort of mainstream Canadian music industry stuff. But when you break it down, wow. Like my God, there's so much incredible metal from up here.
there's just so much incredible music from the third period from all walks. You know, I mean, I would say half of the bands, my favorite bands on the planet, are all from there. So
it's Drake, Justin Bieber, Ryan Adams. That's the big three.
Right there. Fuck no. I mean, no means no. You got Huevos Rancheros. You got Shadowy Man. Obviously, Rush. You know, Voivod. Fucking everyone, dude. It's just so. But we started anyway. Back to Forbidden Cause. I got off the subject. Which is just literally the stupidest name ever. What cause were we was forbidden to us?
You guys always say that. I don't think it's that bad of a name. Like, I'm in a band called Fucked Up, so I really shouldn't be handing out band name advice. But
come on, that's great. Fucked Up, come on.
Forbidden Cause is great. Up. You know,
we were 17. There was no cause that was forbidden. I mean, getting laid, that was forbidden. But that wasn't like we couldn't. It's just that no one wanted to. You could staple $100 bills to us. We still wouldn't have gotten laid, you know? We had no cause. There's no cause.
Survival. Nothing. Donnie, survival. You guys are being beaten up every day because you chose to like heavy metal.
We're Texans. We're used to it. You know what I mean? There's no cause, you know? I mean, that after that band dissolved, that turned into Harm's Way with a Z.
I love that Harm's Way recording. Are you kidding? That record's amazing, dude.
Dude.
Zach was like, "Oh, it sounds like 7 seconds." For years, he told me that.
And that's government flu.
Oh,
that's
government flu. That's it. Yeah, the government
Harm's
flu thing.
Harm's Way was our thrash band. It sounded like, God, we sounded like Beneath the Remains versus like if you mix Beneath the Remains, Sepultura, with South of Heaven. That's what Harm's Way sounded like.
But that there's a recording of the Harm's Way stuff too, right?
I think so. If anyone has it, Zach has it.
Yeah, because I think he sent me that too. Because he sent me something and he's like, oh, it's going to sound like 7 seconds. And it raged. It was
Government flu.
Okay, yeah, the government flu stuff. Yeah.
That stuff I love. That was with our friend Tony. And he taught us what straight edge was. We didn't know. We thought we were just like the weird goons at parties that didn't drink or do drugs. People would make fun of us for that. Like, you're not going to drink? Like, no, because I don't want to be a drunk dumbass like you are, falling all over the place, you know? And we just thought we were weird until we met my friend Tony, and he goes, oh, no, you guys are straight edge. We're like, the fuck straight edge? And he told us, he goes, it's like bands like Minor Threat and, you know, 7 Seconds and then Bad Religion and all this. We were like, shit, yep, we're straight edge. That's what we are. Fucking ain't right, we're straight edge. You listen to Gorilla Biscuits, like, all right, I'm fucking straight edge, you know? And it was, we had something to grasp onto. Mm-hmm. Not only was it music we loved, but it had an ideal that we were. It was like, oh shit, we're not weird anymore. We can be part of something, you mm-hmm. know? We're part of something now. This is far cooler. And the music rips. So yeah, we're that, you know?
Yeah, I was the same way. I never wanted to drink, never wanted to do drugs. And finding straight edge, it gave me not like an identity, but more like a cause. Like,
yes, you
know, like something
we could all. A forbidden cause.
A forbidden cause. Exactly. And it was forbidden because no one was like, your entire life is being encouraged to drink and do drugs. And
yes, you know,
you're choosing not to.
That's what I hated. We saw it our whole lives just with, you know, people coming over to our parents' house and grown adults acting stupid, you know, people we grew up with, you know, like one day we're in eighth grade, everything's cool. Then we hit ninth grade and they're going to parties and they're acting like dumbasses because they can drink. The hell, you know, and it never made sense to me of wanting to get that way so you can feel better or cooler. And I understand everyone has their own reasons. So I'm not judging anyone. I'm saying from my own perspective, I never understood it ever. Because to me, it was going to keep me from being able to play. Like, well, if I can't focus, then I can't play bass, you know, good. And I'm working on getting better at that. I don't need an inebriate or something to kill what I'm already barely grasping onto at this point. You know, yeah. I got enough troubles of my own figuring this shit out. I don't need alcohol or anything to kill it for me. So, and it wasn't, I guess a lot of people just feel more relaxed with it. And I never felt that way, you know? And I think Zach and I have this theory that our parents did so many drugs in the 60s and the 70s that it's just in us. It's just in our DNA anyway. So we don't need it. Like, oh, okay. We just feel like that all the time.
Yeah. Was that Salvador Dali thing? Is I don't need drugs. I am drugs.
Pretty much, you know, and I think we were just born that way. Like, oh, okay. No, you know, we're just born this way. But so it was, go ahead, please.
Oh, no, you mentioned going to that Pantera show. So bands were coming through Sherman, or like at least local bands were coming to play.
Oh, yeah, because it's only in, we're only about 45 minutes, barely an hour north of Dallas. So there would be clubs up there. It was part of like the circuits and stuff like that. And people would go up and play and have fun. Then they go back and haul ass back to Dallas and stuff. And so lots of people played this Electric Company place, you know, and they were always there. They were there about every other month, I think so. And then they started getting more popular. And I think they played there again once after Anselmo joined the band, right when they did Power Metal, that record. Mm-hmm. And then we didn't hear from them again until Cowboys from Hell came out. And we're like, what the fuck is this? Like, holy shit. But still at that point, it was great. But at that point, Zach and I were already in like, okay, well, when's the new Pestilence record coming out? So, so they were already like, nah, I want to find out that new fucking Pestilence record. Let's talk about that. You know what I mean? That's already where our heads were. So we were already still not really impressed, you know, with that. I think we were some of the few Texans that weren't impressed or weren't fans of theirs right out of the gate. It took a couple records. Far Beyond Driven was the first record of theirs that I like, oh shit, now we're fucking talking, you know?
So were there any punk bands locally that would be playing too? Like Sherman-based punk bands that would, I guess Government Flu would have been playing those type of bands now.
Yeah, we were about the only ones. We had to go to Dallas for the punk bands, you know? We had to do that. And we only had one show. We played at the Slip Disc, you know? Our friend Sean Bailey booked us that gig. And I played with Plastic Gloves because I saw Jello do it and I thought it'd be cool. And I'm like, wait, I can't play. Fucking dumbass, man. So anyway.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you can't make this shit up. You can't make it up, man. And Zach was like, you're going to play with those? Like, Jello did it. He was singing, dumbass. He wasn't playing a bass. Like, it'll be fine. It wasn't fine. So we were handing out flyers for that at Bill's Records and Tapes and met Banning Lion, who we started Hagfish with. So Government Flu did that one show, and our drummer Daniel, who was from Harm's Way, quit because he didn't like playing the punk rock stuff. He wanted to go back and do other things. So we needed a drummer. And we auditioned Banning, and it was on a drum kit that he wasn't used to. So the audition went pretty shitty, you know, but we loved hanging out with him and talking to him. And he was like, guys, if you try me out on my stuff, it'll be far better. I promise. So Zach was like, you know what? Let's just you and I go down there and play with him and see what happens. So we did. And we were like, let's just start our own band with him, you know? And we wanted to do different things, and it just kind of clicked right from there. And that's how we started Hagfish.
And by that point, you guys were already pretty deep into sort of the Descendants fandom, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, we were at the tip of it. We were still discovering them. My friend Tony would be telling us, like, Bill Stevenson's the best drummer on the planet, you know? He's not far off still, you know?
Yeah.
Still is one of the top, I think.
It's fun watching. I didn't mean to cut you off, but it's fun watching. No. It's fun watching a drummer watch Bill Stevenson, and just like how much they're like, they just appreciate everything. It's like stuff that I could never see. That they're like, oh my god, you can't believe what he's doing, like the shit he's doing. Because like, as terms of like, he's not, you know, he's not up there killing the drum kit in a way that you'd expect, you know, to be blowing away a drummer. But the drummers are like, no, what he does is so perfect and so methodical. He's the drummer's drummer.
He ruins people's lives, you know. I've seen so many drummers watch him and go, oh, and I just watch them shaking their head like, this sucks, you know, and they just shrug their shoulders and walk like, yeah, I mean, I do it watching the Carl. So I'm like, oh, fuck, I'm going to, I've got a lot of firewood I can sell then. I'm not going to need it after watching him. We were like at the top. We were just now getting into Bad Religion and Descendants. And then Banning turned us into All as well, you know. And then we started just going down rabbit holes of Mob Vishnu Orchestra from that and even more Black Flag. Just everything. Everything known to man, you know. And it really opened up our eyes. Just we were constantly looking for new people to meet because, A, to my brother and I, basically from our dad, he was bringing us records and bringing us music. So to us, we were going to find out more information from other people than we could ourselves. You know, meeting my friend Brad and William turned us on to punk rock and metal, big time metal. Then meeting Tony turned us on to straight edge and hardcore. Meeting Banning turned us on to so many other bands and so much stuff. So we were always just thirsting to meet new people. Like, whoa, what is that guy going to turn us on to? You know, every person that we met that we thought was kind of like us, like, all right, what are you listening to? I met some friends of mine named Colin and his brother. They had a band called The Diversions. They loved No Means No. Turned us on to No Means No. We're like, fuck, great. Now we're going to buy every No Means No record there is. And we did. So it was just, you know, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have that.
Well, and it's like you were saying earlier, how now you can go on and hear any Violence record you want. You can hear any Siege recording you want. Like, there's just everything there. But you don't have that kind of need to be as, I guess, religiously adherent to one record. Like, if you got that No Means No record, whether you liked it or not, you're going to listen to it until you start to like it.
Yes. Yeah, dude, you paid a lot of money.
You paid a lot. Thing, man. Yes.
Fuck, that shit was expensive. Like, yeah. Well, but sometimes it just didn't work. Like, you remember that band Etrope? Zoetrope?
Yeah.
We were so, and Raven. Raven was another one. Zach and I were like, Raven, the beast is back. Holy shit, this is going to be amazing. Oh my God, it was fucking horrible. We were like, and my dad was like, so would you guys think about that record? And we were like, sucked. And he was like, well, hold on, let me listen to it. Ugh, you know, but, you know, then again, sometimes you can judge a book by its cover, like Possessed, Seven Churches. We bought that. Guess what? It's fucking awesome. You know?
Yeah. And we showed our mom, that
record. Oh my God, with upside down crosses and blood and just with the logo, like, this is going to be badass. And we had it laying around. And our mom would always go in and do our, like, clean up our room. So, like, hey, Mom, want to show you this. We bought this record. We just want you to see it so you don't think we're Satanists. And she looked at the back and was like, oh, you boys don't believe this shit, do you? I'm like, no, we just like the music. All right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah. It's like that kind of stuff, you know, is going to be amazing. And you don't... You can try stuff out before you buy it so many times now. Mm-hmm. You really can. And it's cool for record nerds and music nerds like us, but it also kills that zing of when you find something that's great because you've been bitten in the ass so many times beforehand, you know?
Well, even when I love something, you know, there's just so much stuff to listen to and new stuff coming out that I don't give myself a chance to like really study it in the way that I did records back then. And, you know, I think like, you know, yourselves and All and Descendants with Hagfish, like that was a band. You guys were kids that heard a sound and were like, we want to do our own take on this sound. And that only comes from studying a sound and understanding it.
Oh, it did. And we also had the advantage of, we had a drive an hour back from Sherman to Rockwall where Banning lived. So we were listening to music, going to his house on the weekends and then listening to music on the way back. We were always listening to music with him. We just associated ourselves with music nerds. That's how we've always been. Our best friends have been people who love music. My wife is a huge music nerd. We don't necessarily have the same music tastes. It pretty much, we love the hives and rocket from the crypt. Past that, it's like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But the thing I love about her is the bands that she loves, the artists that she loves, she is emphatic about them. She loves every lyric, every album. She has everything. And so it's like, I think as long as you have that, you're good. It doesn't matter if you have the same music tastes. Who cares? You're not necessarily going to love the same as your partner and all that stuff, you know? But as long as you love music equally, that's all that matters, you know? And so we've always had that when relationships with friends or anyone, they have to love music as much, you know? Doesn't matter what it is, as long as they have that passion for it. You know?
Yeah, for me, it doesn't even have to be music. It could be if someone's passionate about, someone's obsessed with model trains. I find that interesting because they'll bring you into their world a little bit. Maybe not crypto. Yeah. Crypto's the one thing that if someone's obsessed with it, I don't really want to hear about it.
You're right. Because again, my wife she's obsessed with Lego and trains. And so Lego trains, oh shit. I mean, oh shit, you can't see it, but like behind me.
That's awesome. That's
a Lego. The behind me right back there, that's just Lego cars. Star Wars Lego. I can show you when we're done, I'll show you her office. It's amazing. But that's what I love. I love people who are obsessed because they understand passion.
Mm-hmm.
They understand passion for something other than fucking football.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Or Dallas Cowboys are getting hammered on the weekends or something. It's like, no, they put their time and their energy into something that you can hold, you can listen to, you can really get into, that is in your control. Not whether 11 assholes pass the ball or they don't. Who gives a shit? You're going to let that ruin your weekend? No, you know. But if Voivod are coming through town with Violence and you can't go because it's the Dimension Hatross tour and Piggy got brain cancer and they canceled the whole tour, that bums out your fucking weekend because that's what happened to us.
Yeah.
We were so bummed, you know? But you know what I mean? And it's like that I understand. Getting mad about a football game, losing, I can't compute that. It doesn't register in my head, you know? I don't get it.
You know, I find it interesting when you think about that kind of all cruise record scenes and how big it was. God. And it seems like it just, there's no real, you know, sort of remnants of it in any sort of way. Like it was like one of the biggest sort of subsects of punk for a time. And then it just seemed like it just disappeared. And I guess Hagfish transcends that and winds up doing sort of like part of the Fat Records world and sort of like a larger sort of pop punk scene beyond that world. But you know, in terms of bands like that, Mega City 4, Doughboys, all like that kind of adult pop punk scene that existed for a time. Like it really is extinct. It feels like
it is. And I would think that it kind of carried over into some of the pop punk bands, but they pretty much just stay true to the descendants. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of them, like the Blink 182s and guys like that and Less Than Jake and all those guys, are definitely, I think they're all fans, but you go more for descendants. You know what I mean? Definitely. All, it would kind of depend on some of the records. You know what I mean? Because they got crazy with some shit, you know? I mean, I love, God damn it, the EP with Dave Smalley, the last one. It's got Postage on it.
See, that's the thing. It's like, I find I do have some all records, but like all is, like you're saying, it's like a cult, a separate cult. And you can be a Descendants fan. Everyone's a Descendants fan, but to be an all fan, that is to be a hardcore fan.
That's different. Yeah. And I love all but also like we got into them when Scott was in the band. Mm-hmm. So All Roy Saves had just come out. So after we got into them, they played Dallas and we went on that tour and it was fucking amazing. It blew our minds, you know, and to see these guys on stage, and it was so much different than seeing Slayer or Anthrax or those other bands. These guys were right here. We could touch them if we wanted. We can go out and talk to them. And we did. Like, whoa, we're talking to them. Blew our minds. Like it was just another thing of, you know, punching the veil pretty much and going behind Oz's curtain like, oh, wow, that's kind of bullshit. These are just really good people. They're just up there doing the thing that we want to do and they're being real about it. But you're right about all. they would go down some weird, dark paths, you know, and just some crazy stuff that you're either along for the ride or you're not. And they don't give a shit. They're going to do it anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, who cares? And it was awesome. I mean, like All Roy Says, or I'm sorry, Saves, that record's basically just Descendants meets Birds of Fire from Avishnu Orchestra. That's all it is. It is.
But you,
it
you
totally is.
You bring up a great point with that too, whereas like Descendants are just like a pop punk band. And I don't mean that to be dismissive, like a hardcore punk pop punk band, but like All is closer to a prog rock band. Like the way they're approaching this music is progressively.
Well, and they Descendants got into that from the record All because they got Stefan and Carl in the band. And Stefan and Carl brought in so many more different things that Bill was already into. They loved Mahavishnu. He already loved Mahavishnu. He told me that when he picked Carl up from the bus station, right? Never met him before. Only talked to him on the phone briefly. Carl comes in. Bill's driving. And they didn't really know what to say. So Bill said, he goes, so who's your favorite bass player? And Carl went, Geezer Butler. Bill said he thought to himself, we're going to be fine. Badass, you know.
Yeah.
But it's they finally had two guys that were at his musicianship level and able to stretch out and do these things that he wanted to do. And they kind of just went crazy with it, you know? And that's what appealed to Zach and I, because our dad also turned us on to prog rock, King Crimson, Old Genesis. Yes, definitely. It was, we loved hard rock, new wave, but it was also, all right, but make sure you listen to Yes and King Crimson too. You guys can listen to Metallica all you want. Listen to Yes. Listen to this stuff as well. We had to, you know, and so that appealed to us as well. Like these guys are punk rock, but they're throwing in jazz. They're throwing in prog. They're throwing all this great shit in because we didn't want to just play just the Ramones. Although the Ramones, you know, one of the best bands ever, we weren't at that level yet where we could see how genius the Ramones were. We just thought if you played a lot of notes and it was all this stuff, it was cool and it was married with punk rock. We weren't at the Ramones level of getting into the DNA that it was how mind-blowing. Once we did, that's what flipped Hagfish around.
But I think that's the difference between the Ramones and a lot of other bands is that Johnny is the first to tell you that he wasn't a musician. Like he could obviously do some great things with that guitar, but he viewed it more like he was a guitarist and this was a tool. He didn't think of himself as an artist, at least from any conversation I had with him or other anything I've, you know, read that he said.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing from what I've read, but it's, if you get into the DNA of them and playing it correctly, it's the same as trying to play AC/DC.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
People think it's easy. Like, oh, you think it's easy. Go do it. See how easy it is. You're going to sound like shit. The only band that can do it right is AC/DC. They're the only ones. Yeah. We can all sit there and dissect it and everything. And they're like, oh, well, they're doing this. Doesn't matter. We can get up there and try as best we can. It's not going to sound as good because we're not AC/DC or the Ramones. You know, like, oh, you think that's easy to play all downstroke 16th notes constantly, correctly, on the beat, perfectly? Have fun with that. See how long it takes. See how far you get. They get halfway between beat and the breath before someone's arms are tired and the tempo slowed down and they just can't do it. It's not fucking easy to do.
Yeah. Well, and like, that's why, you know, Clem Burke was never the drummer. Like he only made two shows and he's one of the great drummers to ever come out of punk, but couldn't be a Ramone.
No, he was fantastic, man. You had to be geared for that kind of a thing. It wasn't even, it's like, yeah, you have to be more military. It's all in the hands and all in the, it was way more of a physical thing than it was just creativity, you know, kind of the same way with AC/DC. It's very physical, you know, very physical thing to do.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
I'm really interested in that whole label group that Hagfish got signed to. And I think the Toadies were in it, Tripping Daisies in it too. And there's maybe a fourth band, or is there a fourth band?
Label group? Which one?
Well, that, like, when you, the first for Buick, man, the first record came out on like that. That weird, like, it was like a Texas promoter that signed all these bands that wind up becoming very important bands, but it felt like you were all like in a circuit together from what Zach's described.
A circuit, yeah, we all had different labels. Toadies were on Grass Records first off. They did Pleather. Then that got picked up by Interscope, mm-hmm. I think. We were on Dragon Street. Tripping Daisy had gotten, they were kind of one of the first big bands there, and they were just exploding. And that's kind of how we got our start, is because one of their techs, this guy named Steven, loved us. He was a Ramones nut. He started playing us for the guys in Tripping Daisy and got us to open up for them. And then we just kind of, people loved us, and it went from there. And so then their label, Dragon Street, picked us up because they had sold them to Island Records. So they paid for Buickman, basically.
Okay. You know? And was that like, and that was, you guys would tour together, right? Like, I remember Zach telling me that you weren't necessarily touring on the national circuit. You tour nationally, but it was always in a separate little world or something.
At first, yeah. Before, like, around, God, when we started touring, it was like 93, 94. That was about the start of it. Tripping Daisy had just gotten signed. And there was a band called Course of Empire that had been signed. And Rev was on Sub Pop. All these things were slowly starting to happen. Toadies were putting out some records. You know, they were putting out Pleather, but they hadn't been signed to Interscope yet. And we were all slowly kind of like emerging out of like the mud. You know what I mean? We all knew our thing. I mean, we all would go to each other's shows and hang out and stuff. But we were starting to step out of Texas more. And Hagfish had this really great agent named Paul Nugent. And he would just send us places. We were like his Lewis and Clark. He was like, hey, guys, I got you some good money. These shows could suck. Let me know. Yeah. And then I'll start sending the other bands. So we would give him the okay, like, that place was cool, or that place sucked, you know? And then he would start sending other bands and build up routes that all the other bands from Dallas could take and do, you know? But we were kind of the fearless ones. He was like, well, it's about a 1,000-hour drive. The money, shit. I'll send Hagfish. They'll do it, you know? And I'm like, yeah, you got it. We'll go. Fucking dumbasses. But it's how we first got to Chicago and made a lot of fans there. And same way with going to LA, same way with going to Florida. We would just be like, we were up for the adventure. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll make money. We won't starve. We'll get to play shows and we'll have fun. So yeah, what's the downside here? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, the worst that can happen is we're going to, you know, get stalled somewhere when the van breaks down. It was going to happen anyway. And it did all the time. Like, okay, well, we knew it was going to happen, but at least we played some shows. We had a great time and we made it back home, you know, wait to do it again.
Were they kind of pitching Dallas at that time as the next Seattle? Because there's, like you're saying, there's like four or five bands that were signed.
They were. And a lot of the labels were looking at that, but it didn't work because if you go to Seattle, they had a sound, you know, if you went to New York, even like even though Talking Heads and Ramones and Blondie necessarily didn't have a sound, they kind of did. It worked, you know. Same way with Chicago, Smashing Pumpkins and those bands coming out, you know, or Kansas City and bands. But Dallas didn't have that. We had none of that. You had the Reverend Horton Heat, Tripping Daisy, Course of Empire, us. You had the Toadies. You had Bob Goblin. You had so many different bands, Brutal Juice and Baboon. None of us sounded alike. No one sounded alike, because to us, we were like, we're not going to sound like the Reverend Horton Heat. We'll get clowned. Like, oh, you guys are just ripping off the Reverend Horton Heat. Or there would be bands that would try to come up and there would try to be a Reverend Horton Heat. There was a couple of bands that tried to sound like Hagfish, Tripping Daisy, all of this stuff, and none of them ever went anywhere because people in Dallas were like, there already is that band. Do something new, you know? Once you do something new, then we'll come see you. Until then, fuck off. So it never really worked at all as a scene so much as like you would think of a Seattle thing, you know? Because none of us would ever try to sound like each other, like, ugh, fuck no, we're not going to do that, you know? And it's the same thing as the Texas rebellious spirit. We have to be individuals, you know?
It's still interesting because, like, even at the time, being a fan of all these bands, getting into this music kind of separately, listening to college music samplers and things like that, I never associate them with each other. Like you're saying, the sound is so disparate. But the fact that you've got, like, you know, ran off a list of six bands there, all of them got signed to national deals and toured kind of nationally and had a profile. I can think of Smashing Pumpkins and Poster Children from Chicago and that scene. But, like, the fact that all these, and you're all, like you're saying, you're all friends. You all knew each other.
Oh, yeah. It would be, I mean, we would all hang out. We played together. We'd hang out together. You know, we were all touring at the same time. So my wife would go downtown to Deep Ellum and hang out. And like, well, how was it? I would call her from the road. Dead. All you guys are on the road. No one's here. Then at the end of the year, none of us were touring. So it was just party. Like, hey, the hell are you doing? And then we're all telling stories and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, and it was a fun, fun time. It was a really cool scene because no one was trying to bite each other. No one was trying to like one up. We were all feeding off of each other. If I'm listening to Bob Goblin's brand new record, oh my God. Okay. Well, now we got to go do something that's better than that. Or whenever Jim came out with the Liquor in the Front, Poker in the Rear, like, fuck, are you kidding me? Toadies with Rubberneck. When that came out, Jesus Christ, no one could believe it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell? Because they used to be just, they would play, but Todd, or Vaden, our singer, he went by Todd at that point, he would just scream bloody murder. His face would go as red as your shirt right now. And no one would look at, everyone was just, the band would look at their instruments except him. He's looking at everyone and just staring the audience down like, fuck with me. I fucking dare you. That was his look as always.
Yeah.
And the songs were crazy and written weird. And they were like in a very acquired taste. You know, if you were a Toadies fan, like, oh shit. Okay. We all were. Everyone in Hagfish was. We loved them. Every time we played, we try to get on bills with them, everything. And then Rubberneck came out. Like, what in the fuck? Where did that come from?
Well, it's funny, too, because I can't think of another period of time where I know that many bands from Dallas. Like, there's obviously Power Trip and sort of more recently, I know a lot of bands from Dallas. But still, that scene, like, there were just so many bands popping off there. And it felt like it was like a real fertile but brief period for music there.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And it was just a cool, I think we got in at the exact right amount of time because we had started when we did Hagfish. It was, you know, we were playing this place called the Jumpin' Java Joint and we would play our own really fast songs and sprinkle in like Frogger from Bad Religion, you know, some Circle Jerk songs and stuff like that. And then we'd walk around Deep Ellum and look at all the bands that were playing the clubs, like, fuck, we want to play there, you know? And we knew we weren't going to get to, like, okay, fine, we'll stick to the clubs that we're doing. But then we got George in the band and he was writing cool songs, but they were still fast, you know? Mm-hmm. The lyrics were too fast, no one could hear it. Then we got this drummer named Scott Carter that's on Buick Men as well. He'd only been playing a couple of years, but he could play like Tommy Ramone. He couldn't play fast like Pete Finestone from Bad Religion or Jeff Nelson from Minor Threat, but he could do an easy 1-2-3-4 like Marky Ramone or Tommy Ramone. So we tried that out and the song slowed down and people were actually able to hear roll over like, oh, hey, that's a melody. Shit, that's kind of cool. So that's when things started kind of happening. People were like, oh, these guys have cool songs because they slowed down, you know?
Yeah.
And it made sense. We've got demos, have to find them, of us playing a lot of the stuff that ended up on Buick, man. And it's like a, you know, fucking out of step speed, you know, and it just didn't work until we switched drummers. And then it worked. People could hear, for lack of a better word, the genius of George's writing, you know, which to me it is. The guy's
got amazing lyrics, unbelievable lyrics.
Fucking amazing. And his voice has an innocence to it. He's not like, he's almost like Milo. You know, Milo can sing his ass off, but there's an innocence there. There's feeling, there's passion. There's not, he's not emoting or anything. He's just singing, but it's from his heart. Same thing with George. George looked at himself as a songwriter that we made sing. He didn't want to sing. Wrote, nah, you're the singer. Fuck, dude, come on. You know? And he was like, all right, I'll sing. And he did. And he was great at it. But whenever he did sing, it had this beauty to it, this innocence and just kind of nakedness I always listened to, you know? But at the same time, a cocksureness, weird, you know, that off at the same time.
I think that's why, like, when I first heard it, I was like, he can't be saying that, can he? And then, like, go to the lyric sheet and be like, what? Like, as a kid, like, what is he saying?
No
way.
Eat it while I
wait. This record came out in a store. How can he say this? That's crazy. But
that's awesome. That is so cool. Yeah.
It is such a, it's such a, like, an amazing period of music post Nirvana, where all these sort of disparate sounding bands are all being signed, and it produced kind of this, like, glut of almost incredible music as everyone's searching, or the music industry searching, for the next Seattle. But, like, going back now and looking at all the weird, interesting records that came out during that time, it's amazing.
Yeah. You've got, I mean, you even had bands like Bedhead, you know, turned into the New Year, you know, I mean, they were around at the same time. It was them and then us. And sometimes we'd be on the same bill, like, why are we all on the same bill? Who did this with the Reverend Horton Heat? Why not?
Well, and you did a band with a drummer from Reverend Horton Heat later on, right? Like that. I used to have that 7-inch. What's it called? The
El Diablo.
El Diablo. That's it.
Yes. It was me and Zach Taz. And then, and Toby Bean, who was in Street Dogs, he was the singer, and we just did a quick EP. And we toured all over for about a couple of years. We tried to make it work, and it just, people weren't interested, unfortunately. But we had a hell of a lot of fun playing in that band and learning from Taz. Just a great fucking drummer. Such a good drummer, you know.
Would that band wind up playing with a lot of that sort of Austin, Man's Ruin, garage rock stuff that was kind of happening around the same time?
Yeah, we would do like the super suckers type stuff, you know, kind of those kind of bands, Zeke, that kind of stuff, you know. We were still doing Hagfish at the time as well. It was back and forth. But I think Hagfish had just put out the self-titled record. And we were like, George was having another baby. And it was just kind of like, we were so tired. We kept getting offers. We were getting offers to play Canada with Face to Face and NOFX. We were getting shit thrown at us, but we were fucking exhausted.
Oh, so you guys were going to be on that NOFX Face to Face tour. I think No Use for a Name does it in the end. And that is a big show for me. One of my first shows.
You almost saw us do it. We were
amazing. I was already a fan of you guys. So
we got it offered, and we were like, I remember we were just talking to each other. We had done us all and Zeke. We had done that. We had done the Offspring tour. We had done so much stuff, you know, and it was just kind of writing our record. And there was a record we did in between Lame Ass and the self-titled for London. We did. And writing that thing, making it and getting dropped and having that thing never be released was just such a mind fuck to us. It tired us out. It was exhausting. You know, and yes, sir, go ahead.
No, I just don't think I ever knew there was another record.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was the majority of the songs we worked on them and worked on them. And we talked to a lot of different producers when we were with London for our second London record, like Gil Norton, you know. But he wanted to go to England to make the record. We didn't want to go to England. We'd just come back from England, you know. So he had time to go and make The Color and the Shape of the Foo Fighters, that kind of shit.
Yeah. So, that record.
That record. So we went with a guy named Bo Hill, who taught us a lot. He made Rise with Bad Brains, but he also did Rat, Warrant, and Winger. He was their producer.
Yeah.
And he did teach us a lot about songwriting and playing. We learned a lot from him, but the record, it wasn't us. Mm. And we were just fighting it tooth and nail. We were wanting to go to a different producer. And in hindsight, we should have just let the fucking thing come out, played and toured, and just we would have gotten through it, you know. But the label didn't really like it either, so they dropped us. And within a month, Mike picked us up at Fat. You know, he was doing Honest Ons, and he was like, you know, I'll give you guys the money for it. And we're like, well, we have demos. Do you want to hear them? No. Because it's Mike. He was like, just go make a fucking great record, guys. Here's the money. Whatever you need. Like, in true Mike fucking Burkett fashion, he's just a good dude to a band he likes. Like, no, do what you need to, man. Like, total punk rock. And that's why we love that scene. You know what I mean? We were at our lowest. We'd been dropped, everything. Like, what the fuck are we going to do? Here comes Mike. Here you go. Like, we want to go with Bill and Stefan. I don't care. That's what I was going to suggest. I'll send them the money. Make the record. And that's what we did. And he didn't hear it until we were done. And he goes, it's a great record. I'll put it out. You know?
I've asked him about it too, and I've never really gotten, like, sort of, well, at least an answer that I'm satisfied with. But I find, like, the fact that he does Honest Dons at the same time he is Fat. Fat has so much brand recognition, so much, like, you know, but I guess it also had baggage, and maybe that's the reason. I think that is the reason he said he did Honest Dons, so he could have different sounding bands. But to me, all these bands would have been okay on Fat. It would have, if anything, made Fat sound a little more broad.
Well, I think at that time, if you think about it, hindsight, now it would, because they have so many different bands on Fat. But at that point, Fat was known for No Use for a Name and Lagwagon and Strung Out. You know, it had that sound. So to have a band like Hagfish or Riverdales, you know what I mean? It was us and Riverdales. We were on there. And the Teen Idols.
Chicks stuff Dig like It, that. Dancehall Crashers, I think. It.
That, exactly. So it wouldn't have worked. They had to try something else out, you know, and that was mainly led by Mark Tomo. You know, he was running Fat and then decided he wanted to try this. And Mike was like, you guys would be perfect for Honest Dons, you know? So he gave it a try and we were just happy. Like, fuck, this is great. You know, it was, we still got the same press. The people from Fat got, we got everything. It was still the same stuff. We went to Europe, same thing. Same interviews, all of it. It was amazing, you know. But also, we were pretty tired at that point, just from everything that had happened. And I think if we had just taken a couple months break, we probably would have been fine. We probably would have kept going. But there had just been too much. I mean, like 10 pounds of shit had gone into a 5-pound bag at that point for us. I mean, we had been busy straight. George got in the band in 92. So from 92 to 98, we literally did not stop. We toured the world probably three times. We went to Europe three times and did, I think, 15 tours of America, 15 to 20, from 92 to 98, and made three records, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a lot on our psyche at that point. And at that point, some of the other bands from Dallas were kind of breaking up and it was just kind of fizzling out at that point as well, you know? So it all kind of ended at the same, it began at the same time and ended at the same time, you know?
And I know, because I know you do the Meg 7 and you do a couple other projects in there, but were you kind of stepping a little bit away from being in a full-time band for a minute, or like how long before you joined the Toadies is it?
Somewhat I was. Like, I did Mag 7 because I'm a surf nut, and I just did another record called The Tulsa of Doom. It's all me. I'll tell you about that later, though. Because I'm a surf idiot. Why not? I'm in the middle of Texas. Why not love surf music, you know? I told you, Wavos and Shadowy Men are two of my favorite bands. They're amazing. And
can you surf in the Gulf?
Yeah, but I'm not going to go there. Fuck that. I don't love it that much, you know? Well,
I'm going to say there's more surfing in Texas than there is in Calgary. So I guess you've been to Wavos right. for that.
Yeah, but Brent's such a badass. Brent J. Cooper, everybody. Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Calgary zone, you know? So I did that basically because I was free. I was done. We were done with Hagfish. Zach had already joined GWAR. So I was kind of left to my own devices. I didn't have my partner in crime with me anymore. So I was like, shit, now what do I do? You know? And I found Dan Phillips that was in Slow Ride and True Widow, the guitar player and singer in True Widow. Before he did that, him and another friend of ours started a surf band. And the whole point of it was to not be Hagfish. It was, this riff sounds cool, let's do it. Because there's a certain amount, and Zach will agree with me, so will Tony, so will George, of Hagfish Damage, where we pick apart every bar of every song. Is it right? Oh, is it not? Okay, well then we got it. We go bar by bar, you know?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to play music. And then Zach and I had Only Crime, you know? After a while, we did Armstrong. After he was getting done with the GWAR, we did Armstrong. Then that turned into Only Crime. Zach went straight into Only Crime from that. Then I got in the band. Then he got in Rise Against, and I went home for a bit. Oh, see, I loved Matt that took Zach's place. Matt Hoffman, great fucking guy, great guitar player, but at that point, I was just tired and I just wanted to go home for a while. And I kind of thought, I'm done for a while. I'm not really going to do anything. Then I found out about the Toadies gig and here I am, you know, I couldn't believe it because they were always one of my favorite bands. And I couldn't believe I got, you know, I was able to do it. They were like, well, we're going to play this song. Yeah, I already know that one. Well, now we're going to play this song. Well, I already know that one too. You know, I already knew this shit.
I find Grass Records too, where like that, the first Toadies label, I find that label so interesting. Like obviously that Toadie Records is incredible. The 15 record they did is incredible. There's so many unbelievable records on there. And then it becomes a label that puts out Evanescence.
I know. Isn't it fucking weird?
It's so weird. It's like someone's ear just went out the window or something.
It did. And it's just, they had all this great shit. And I can't remember. They had some other bands, Grass did, that signed. And I can't, it was a weird story. I think they had Pollen as well.
Commander Cody. Cody, which is the pre-Bright Eyes band. They had the Precursive band too was on there. Like it's just, it's wild some of the stuff they were signing. And it's all these scenes that are disparate, but all of them are incredible to look back upon and where these bands came from or where they went. And then the new metal stuff comes in.
No. Yeah. That was a dark day for music. Yeah. Actually, Zach was telling someone about this right when Korn were getting big. It was our first European tour and we were in London at the Columbia Hotel. Did you guys ever stay there?
I don't think so. No, we looked at Matador had an apartment in the building, so we'd sleep in bunk beds every time we played there. It was kind of cool. It was right above the warehouse, so you could go down and get free records in the morning.
Oh, you dick. That's awesome.
I know. I want to get back on Beggars just for the shopping spree.
No shit, dear God. Well, if this was the Columbia, it was ran down at that point, but it was like the Rock and Roll Hotel. It used to be like the Rock and Roll Days Inn in Chicago, just where all the bands played, or all the bands stayed. And we were there one night and it was in the front room hanging out was us, Waddy from the Exploited, this band called Lords of Brooklyn, and Korn. This makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It works. Well,
and we're all hanging out until the Lords of Brooklyn were going to get in a fight with Waddy. And Zach went over to him. And he was like, hey, guys. And there was like three or four of them. Zach was like, guys, you don't want to do that. And they were like, Yeah. It's like, it's just him against us. And Zach was like, yeah, those aren't good odds. Yeah, you're going to need to go get more guys. You're Brooklyn and all, but this is Waddy. don't do it. So, you know.
Yeah, it's I don't know, like you're saying, it's a real interesting period in music prior to sort of the new metal, I guess like pop punk ascendance and post the kind of grunge alternative thing where it's just like this weird stew of all different types of sounds and an industry that's looking for the next thing to latch onto.
Yeah, they didn't know. So they were just throwing everything at the wall to see what would happen. We had so many friends that got record deals that they never did anything with it, unfortunately. And they put out amazing fucking records. If anyone's listening, look for the Bob Goblin record, 12-Point Master Plan. Amazing record. It's one of my favorite of all time. You know, the guy, Matt, the singer, is a genius. They're all amazing musicians. And unfortunately, it didn't do anything. But it's an amazing fucking record. You know, it's just incredible. But, you know, the record label that they were on didn't believe in the band. They just picked them up to try it out. And so that's this other shitty thing. These major labels were picking bands up because we saw it happen so many times to our friends. They were picking them up thinking, hey, we'll just give these guys some more money than they've seen. It'll be a drop in the bucket for us. We'll literally throw it out there. And if it doesn't do anything, we'll move on to the next. And then they're killing these guys' hopes and dreams, you know, that they've worked their entire lives for. And it's dashed. And then most of them don't even go back up to play. It happened to Funland. Clark Vogler, who's in the Toadies, his band, Funland, were on Arista. They put out one EP.
And that's it.
And that's it. And they're an amazing band, you know.
Did Hash Palace ever get signed to a major label?
God, you are good.
I have all that 7-inch.
You know what? Greg, their singer, just died last year.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it stinks. He was a really nice guy. When I dated my wife, when we started dating, he was dating her roommate. So he and I would hang out a lot. Really nice guy. And their bass player was just a sweet guy. Really good. My wife was friends with those guys. She loved that band. She's got some, I'll have to find some Hash Palace stuff that she's got saved. I'll send it to you. I'll show you pictures.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. If I send it to you, she'll divorce me.
She's a collector. But, you don't want to get steal
for Yeah. No, but it's some cool stuff, but they were cool guys. I don't think they were one of those bands that pushed it. They got bigger. Them and Locos Gringos and Three on the Hill and a lot of these bands got popular, kind of paving the way for the Tripping Daisies and the Hagfishes and all these others. So they were there first. Then we all kind of came in behind them and we're just standing on their shoulders to go farther, but they paved the way for us, you know, and Hash Palace were one of those, definitely.
Yeah, so it's almost like the wave, I guess, before the band, your bands, or like this wave of bands we're talking about.
Yeah, it had to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. Someone had to start it up in Deep Ellum. So they did. They went and crashed these clubs. Like, well, we're going to play. Huh? Yeah, we're going to play. And then they would bring in shitloads of people. And that paved the way for the other bands to come in. Like, well, those dumbasses are doing it. Why can't we fucking go do that, you know?
Yeah.
That's what Zach and I saw. We saw a lot of bands that were like, we're fucking better than them. Let's go do this shit, you know? And then we did. We got in and we're cocky. So we proved ourselves right, I guess, you know?
Yeah. And I guess it's like you need, you know, every generation tries to take it further and shoot further than the one before them. So you kind of need to you need that launching pad to go and do what everyone did.
I think after that, there were some good bands that came after that, but I think the labels had already like, nah, it didn't happen. So we're going to go to the next city. And so they just kept looking around for other people. You know, it didn't really click. It did for a bit. You know, Tripping Daisy did well. The Reverend was doing great, but that wasn't enough to ensure like a good thing that the labels were going to come back and check all of it out, you know. Obviously, the Toadies were by far the biggest band from that era and that still do well. You know what I mean? And but looking back on it, if you look at a lot of those records and the stuff, the bands that they influenced, Zach and I meet a lot of bands that are peers of ours who really loved Hagfish that we never would have known. Like, You did? And it's cool to see. You know, it's cool to hear that.
Well, I guess with you and Reverend Horton Heat, both of you guys kind of fall into scenes. Like you can kind of, like a national scene, I mean, or international scene.
No, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Punk and rockabilly, you know, and we did so much. I just got off of a 2-month tour with Reverend Horton Heat. You know, I've spent so much of my time with the Reverend Horton Heat for 30 years now. And I mean, I'm not complaining. Shit, to call them friends and that I've spent that much time with them. All right. Okay. I'm cool with that. You know, they were our first big, well, actually Tripping Daisy was our first big tour. We did a tour with Bad Brains when God of Love came out for like 2 weeks, which was insane.
What was that like?
I'll tell you later, dude. I don't want this recorded. I'll tell you later. Okay. It was, well, I do like one night we were at the Trocadero in Philadelphia and they wouldn't play. You know, I don't know what the deal was, but they weren't going to play. We had played and they would come out and play a couple songs and go off, come out, play another couple songs and leave the stage. Finally, it's Philadelphia. You know, you're going to give them a reason to riot. Have fun with that. Yeah. We had never been to Philadelphia before and we were going to New York the next night. And so we were like, holy shit, we gotta get the fuck out of here. So we go out of the alleyway where the Trocadero was, and people are on either side of their bus rocking it back and forth. You know, they were trying to get at our van. We were like, where are the opening band? We're the shitty bald guys, the punk band. And people are like, all right, fuck you guys. You know, people liked us,
yeah,
but they figured out who we were, like, let's not hassle them. Those poor guys.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the tour I think there's a fist fight in Toronto when they played Toronto and that was the end of it.
That is the tour I'm talking about. And it happened, I guess after Philly. Philly was, I think, the last night and we jumped off and did something else and went to New York. We didn't do New York with them and they went off with Beastie Boys.
Yes.
That happened 4 days after this incident. So we were like, they're with the Beastie Boys. This is going to be amazing. Great. And then a few days later, we're like, oh, shit. And I think we heard about it. Like, oh.
And I think the story I heard, it was in Al Nolan's apartment from Trigger Happy.
Really?
When the fight happened. If I'm not mistaken, I got to double check that with him. But I think that was what he told me back then.
Yeah, it was a crazy tour, man. But for us, we were like, Bad Brains? You fucking kidding me? We get to hang out and open for Bad Brains every night. I mean, one time, Daryl, the bass player, started playing the top of the regulator. And I'm talking to Zach. We're talking, and then he starts playing it. And we're like, oh, shit. And we start running. And then he stops right before it comes in. So we're like, damn it, fucker. But to sit and talk to him was a mind opener for me. I was just sitting there talking to him, you know, asking him questions, watching him play. You know, we never missed a single night. We would get done, clean off really quick, and as soon as they played, we watched every single night. It was never one of those, we'll go back and hang out and do our own thing. Nope, never. We're like, this Bad Brains, we're gonna watch every fucking night. And we did, all of us did, just because it was our first big tour, you know. So that was a great way to start.
Well, I could punish you forever, Zach, but I'm sorry, Donnie. I'm sorry to do
that. Dude, I got nothing else to do.
I do it to my kids all the time.
Will.
I do that to all my kids all the time. Like my mom
used to do that before caller ID. I would call her and she'd go, Zach? No, Mom. Donnie? With a question mark, like, is there another one? only two of us.
I do have to ask you for your perspective on the greatest story of all time, which is you guys connecting with MVP, because I think, I just want to hear your take on everything too, because having heard both, you know, your brothers and MVP's side of things, it felt like this brief encounter was so pivotal to both of their trajectories afterwards. Yeah. And I was just wondering how you kind of felt it when, or did it have the same sort of impact on you?
I just thought Hassan, at that point, he was Al, you know, I just thought he was just, again, I was telling you about, we were just interested in meeting new people. So, and I've heard his point. He was like, well, fuck, I'm going to roll these guys. We didn't know that at the time until later. We were like, we were afraid you were going to roll us. Oh, I was. Like, shit. We were kidding. I'm not. I was going to. Like, okay, well. But we were just like, I mean, we were bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like, oh, here's a new dude. Let's just hang out, talk to this guy. We didn't know what his background was. We didn't know what he was into. We didn't know what bands he was going to be into to turn us on to. It was kind of real, like, siphoning energy from people. Like, what are you listening to? So I can get into that. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like every new encounter, this guy could be into something badass. And he was. He did turn us on to some great music, you know? But we turned him on to Living Color. We turned him on to some other bands as well. And
Voivod.
Yeah, exactly. Voivod and metal. And just, and another viewpoint of things of him hanging out with my mom and my dad. My parents loved him. They thought he was a great kid, you know? And just someone new, a fresh, someone that wasn't from Sherman. So hanging out with him, meeting him that night, it was a fresh energy. Like, whoa. This is a really cool dude, you know, and hanging out, going to parties, watching Al not take anybody's shit at all. We would go to parties and I never wanted to get in any fights ever. I hated it. I did not like it, you know, and we tried to avoid it. But Al, he didn't give a shit. He was like, this is Tinker Toys. Who's going to do something to me? No one, you know? And the other kids that would try to bully us or other people, they knew it. They thought they were alpha dogs. Then they were like, oh, this guy's the real shit. Well, you know what? I'm going to walk the other fucking way. I'm not going to get in with this guy. But just his outlook on things, it was real. It was a different perspective because we were born and raised in Sherman. We hadn't even really been to Dallas that much, except to go see Slayer or Anthrax or something. Then we got the fuck out of Dodge and we come back to our safe zone in Sherman. He had actually lived, done shit, you know? So we were grilling him about things like, wow, what's this like? What's that like? How is it back home? What happens in Miami? What's this like? What did you do? And I think he liked talking to us about that stuff because we didn't judge him for anything. We're like, whoa, what was that like? We were just interested to hear his perspective and hear his story. And I think he met people that were actually just interested in him. You know, three guys that he, or two brothers, because Billy was there as well. But Zach and myself, just two guys that were interested in him and his story and had really cool parents that were open-minded. Probably another thing that he wasn't really used to, you know, being an African American, hanging out with white kids in Texas in the late 80s and early 90s and stuff, you know? So I think we did a little bit to get rid of those kind of stereotypes for him as well. I hope we did.
He talked to me about it. Like, and you know, I'm not putting words in his mouth when I say this, but like how much hope meeting you guys gave him, especially when he was doing the time in prison, like the fact that,
wow,
you guys knew you're going to do this in music and how this was something that stuck with them, you know, and conversations with you guys in your room and about the hope for a better tomorrow and the idea that there is something beyond the world of today.
That makes me happy. I like that. It's because I could see then he had a huge heart. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't, you know, Hassan wasn't this, he at that, I mean, he was big and gruff and all this and like, I will bust your fucking head open if you fuck with me. But that was a product of defense. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. That was because shit had happened and he had to be that way. That wasn't him, you know? I mean, fuck, I saw him in August. We played Houston. He brought his son to the gig. I hadn't seen him in a long time and it was just so great to see him. So badass to see him. And he's the same person, same with that big heart, you know, but he does jujitsu now as well. And so I'm going to go roll with him when I'm in fucking Houston next time. And it's going to suck so bad for me.
Well, good thing it's jujitsu and not like, you know, so like at least there's, this is a sport that's designed to have, you know, no size advantage necessarily.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Especially when you've been doing at least he's a got the wrestling. You meet wrestlers in jujitsu. God, that, and then he's, I believe his son's a brown belt at this point.
Yeah.
And he has his strength and athleticism. So he has quite a huge advantage, actually.
I'm rooting for the underdog. I'll put money on you, Donnie. I promise.
Don't. I'm not putting money on. I'm putting money on him. You kidding me? I'm not an idiot. I'm putting my money on his ass, man. But you know what I mean? You've met him. He has such a big heart. Mm-hmm. And for someone to say that they looked at us and could look at hope, you know what I mean? That's the real Al / Hassan. You know what I mean? That's the real Hassan right there. Is that he does have a huge heart, and he had it then. You know, my parents could see it. You know, they knew, like, oh wow, this is a really good kid, you know. And he was just, at that point, he just wasn't going to take anyone's shit. And we realized that as well. We're like, fuck, this guy's just like us. He's not going to take anybody's shit either. Let's own this fucking town. You know, we didn't care what happened. We met a compatriot. He was like our fucking fellow soldier of not taking shit from anyone. And you might have to go down for that, but oh well, you know, like unite, you know?
Well, I love to me, it's like this kid coming from a situation where there's no hope. His best friend had just been murdered. People are trying to kill him. And meeting these two metalhead brothers that live on nothing but hope. Like, they're getting picked on all the time by kids. And just like, you know, that this hope that there's something more out there. And it's like, you know, right up till the fact, like, you end up beating up your high school bully. Like, Zach's version of the story is that you end up confronting this high school bully that had picked on you. And I just feel like both of you guys, both groups getting something out of this relationship that ends up somehow playing a factor in where you all wind up, and you're all following your dreams. It's fucking crazy.
It is. It really is a weird story, you know, but it's, and I got to put a lot of it towards my mom and my dad, you know, they did take that hippie aspect of believing in yourself, because they were trounced down on as kids. You know, they were told, you're never going to be shit. You're not going to do this. They didn't have a lot of bright future. So they were like, we're damned if we're going to have our kids be this way. So they told us every day, you're the best. You're the best looking. You're the smartest. We weren't, you know, but they didn't care. They were like, you're going to be great at whatever you do. And I said, well, what if I want to be a ditch digger? They're like, well, then be the best ditch digger. Who cares? Mm-hmm. But be great at whatever it is. We believe in you. We never heard you can't do that, or you're never going to do this. We always heard, yeah, of course you can. Just do it. It's your life. Go do it. Always, 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 day in, day out. Don't take anyone's shit. Don't do that. Their whole point was, if you start taking people's shit now, you're going to do it on down the line. And that means you're going to take no for an answer. And we never did take no for an answer. That was the whole point of the exercise, I think, of our upbringing, not taking no for an answer. So if we're already raised with that, then we always have hope, you know, like, mm-hmm. Well, okay, someone's going to say no, we're going to go, no, that's not going to work. So when you're raised with that, you always have hope. It's like, okay, yeah, we're in this shitty town right now. We're going to get out. How? Don't know, but we're going to. We'll figure it out. It will happen in due time. And you're just, it kind of, I guess, you know, infects the people we're with, hopefully. And I'm glad Hassan saw that, you know, because we were just being us. It's just our daily lives with our parents, you know, and just how we were raised, pretty much.
Yeah. No, there's a conversation he brings up where it was the three of you guys hanging in his room, and Zach turned to him and said, we're going to make it. We're going to make it doing music. And you're going to be, and we're going to teach you how to play guitar, and you're going to come on tour with us. And I just think, like, it's so, that's what an inspiring thing for kids to have that. And it's so awesome that you guys had that, like, to know that, like, yeah, like you're saying, it, we don't know when, but it's going to happen.
It, you know what? I remember he and I were talking about this the other day. I remember we had started Hagfish, and it was a few days after our dad had died. And our friend Scott had, he had struggled with girls his entire life, and he had finally lost his virginity, you know? And he called me. He was like, dude, I got laid last night. I'm like, my dad died an hour ago. Fuck, dude. So all of that. So we did the funeral. We did everything else, you know? And a couple of days after that, he goes, hey guys, I'm going to go to this town, Whitesboro. Why don't you two come with me? I'm going to go see that girl that I was with, and I'm going to hang out with her, you know, and just get you the hell out of town for a while. We're like, okay, it's a great idea. So we rode with him, and he was like, hey guys, can y'all get out of the car and go walk around for a while? Cause we're going to be, you know, making out in the car. And we're like, yeah, that's cool. Well, we totally will. So we got out, and we had already talked about we're going to make it and all this stuff, but we already had, you know, we were really talking about it then. Like, our dad had left. He wasn't going to be around anymore. We were having a good, really good, long, frank discussion. It was one of those things we'd always known we were going to do, but we had never just sat and talked about it. So this was the first time we had really just talked about it of, all right, dad believed in us. Fuck it. We're totally going balls to the wall right now. We're doing this. This is what we have to do. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And we just outlined everything. We talked about kind of just a really good heartfelt discussion between the two of us, you know, instead of just letting shit be known, which is how we'd been raised. You know my brother well, and he and I mean, we're just like this. Mm-hmm. We talk every fucking day. We're each other's best friend, you know? And the majority of things we don't have to talk about. We never did, but sometimes we do. This was one of them. And we just had a great conversation, probably the first heartfelt discussion we'd ever had in our lives. You know, it had taken 19 years to do this. I was 19 at the time. And just about our goals, our futures, what we're going to do this way, we're going to do that way, outlining it. And I remember we're sitting there, and Zach was like, we're going to do this. And there was a pause, and he goes, hey, you want to go fuck with Scott and that girl while they're banging? And I'm like, oh, yeah, totally. Let's go. So we walked back, got on either side of the car, and just slowly, kind of like when Snoopy's coming out of the pumpkin patch, you know, in the Great Pumpkin, slowly put our asses up, like on the window on either side. And that girl started screaming and ran out and went inside. And we were driving back, and Zach and I were like, hey, dude, thanks for bringing us. We really needed this. He was like, yeah, I'm really glad I brought you guys. Like, we really needed it, man. Thank you.
Well, Donnie, I really need this conversation. And anytime you want to come back on here, please know the door is always open. And
thank you.
I'm
so
sorry
much
it took so
me.
Long.
God, no, thank you. You're busy. You're kind of being busy in like one of the world's best punk bands. So you're forgiven.
I can't think of a better way to go out than that.
Thank you, Donnie, for coming on the show. And you're right there. Donnie will be back for part two at some point in the future. And once again, you can check out Donnie's ebook available everywhere, Even If It Kills Me, Martial Arts, Rock and Roll, and Mortality. And you can also check out more information about Zach's band over at thetoadies.net. And yeah, there's a lot of fun. Oh my gosh. Anytime I get to add to that sort of massive ball of yarn that is the MVP Blair Brothers saga, I'm a happy podcaster. All right, that is it for me. Coming up on the next episode of Turn Out a Punk, this is a good one. From the band Husker Du, Greg Norton is on the show. We're going to continue. Actually, I think we're finishing up with our bass player streak. We've had one big long bass solo on Turn Out a Punk for the last month or so. And it finishes up with Greg Norton on the next episode. And that is it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. And just stop hating violence towards people of different faiths and different races, because what we're talking about here aren't political issues. These are basic human rights issues. People deserve to live free, from hatred and oppression and violence and discrimination. So if there's organizations that are affecting positive change in your community or other places and you want to get involved, get involved. It's going to make you feel better about the state of the world if you help affect positive change in it, you know? Speaking of getting involved, start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast. Well, maybe not a podcast. Do whatever. Just make something. Punk is a genre based on participation. This is something I learned from the great Tony Erba a long time ago. And I just saw him the other day. And so I gotta reiterate, this is not a scene that, you know, you just sit passively by and watch pass you by. So make the culture you want to see in this world. Speaking of making things, make a difference in someone's life when you can't live your own. Weird way to put it, but sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. And I've seen it perform miracles. I really have. If you're getting stressed out by all this talk, try meditating. Meditation is something that I have started using and have come to kind of really appreciate. And I know this is not new to probably many of you out there, but for me, it was something I did not, I don't know, didn't take seriously, didn't try. And now it is something that, as I say, it provides me a lot of comfort at times. So try it for yourself. And I think that's it. Is there anything else to say? No, I think that's it. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will see you on the next episode.